Communist International, introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where every week we like to examine important events, current events for conservatives and others. And today we're in a red state of mind, for we're going to discuss a new book by investigative journalist James Simpson, namely, Who Was Karl Marx? The Men, the Motives, and the Menace Behind Today's Rampaging American Left. We want to look at the ideological background and the history of all of these leftist forces, which seem to be overthrowing American society and norms. So, James Simpson, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew. Great to be with you.
All right. Well, starting now, I guess, just looking at the title of your book, Who Was Karl Marx? Was he any better than, say, for example, Che Guevara, who I remember about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there was a German auto company, I guess it was Audi or Volkswagen. They had an advertising campaign where they introduced a new car with Che Guevara, and people protested and said, you know, this guy was really a statist, a brutal person. Why do you want to advertise with this guy? Should anyone have any better view of Karl Marx?
No, you know, they were all of a type, whether you're talking about Marx, Che, the Castro brothers, Mao Zedong, Lenin, Stalin, any of them, they were all really, really degenerate, debauched people. You know, one of Che's, everybody called Che the pig. And it wasn't merely because he on women anytime he wanted to, but it was because he stank. He never bathed. And Karl Marx was similar to that. He stank. He never bathed. His mother said, instead of changing the world, Karl ought to just try changing his underwear. And she harried him weekly to change his underwear, and he always ignored her. He impregnated his maid and then accused Engels, his partner in crime, Friedrich Engels, of being the one who did it. And Engels raised the child as his own and only admitted that it was actually Marx's on his deathbed. Marx was a greedy, selfish, parasitic slob. He spied on his own fellow communists for the German government for pay. He was greedy to a fault, I mean, beyond belief. He used to hang around his ailing relatives waiting for them to die so he could see what he would get in their in the will. And he would report these things to Engels in letters that he would write. And it's just simply stunning what he says, you know, because Marx is put up as this infallible icon, almost a god. And yet Marx's ideology intended to impose on the world the universal slavery and misery that he claimed communism would save the world from. It was just, it's stunning. It's stunning. The kind of person he was is just amazing. Two of his daughters committed suicide. A son-in-law committed suicide. Three of his children starved to death. And while his wife was running around trying to raise enough money to buy a coffin for one of their children, he employed this buxom secretary, useless secretary, who he said he needed to keep up appearances because a man of his stature needed that. It's just simply stunning. It's amazing.
Well, you go through the book and you analyze all of these various Marxist leaders, like Mao Zedong, you know, this murderous tyrant in China. You know, he was kicked out of school. He also came from a relatively wealthy background in China. And
yep.
you talk about the Castro brothers as well, and how they grew up on a wealthy sugar plantation, and They also had problems. The school got kicked out, and, you know, they just really wanted power. Yeah. Have you found any true belief in Marxism, or are these communists in the Soviet Union in the past, or today we look at the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Republic of China, or, you know, look at this self-proclaimed Marxist Patrice Couture, the head of the Black Lives Matter movement, this queer-affirming Marxist lesbian leader. Is there any true belief in any Marxism here, or is there just cynicism and strive for power?
Well, you know, Patrice Couture revealed that she was just like Marx and Engels, another grifter. You know, she used this the Black Lives Matter movement to enrich herself, and she's no different or no better than any of them. But it can be broken down. There are the true communists like Marx, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, Castro brothers, the Kim family in North Korea, and all the various other ones. What they really see in communism is a vehicle for absolute power and absolute unearned wealth at the expense of everybody else. And they don't care about anything else. They are greedy. I call them entrepreneurial parasites. They are greedy to the hilt, and they are willing to do anything to obtain absolute power and wealth. But there were true believers. I talk about one true believer in this book who is probably the most impactful communist that ever existed, and nobody's ever heard of him. His name was Sergei Nechayev. He was an anarchist who wrote the Revolutionary Catechism. And the Revolutionary Catechism was a three-page document that became the blueprint for communist revolution. Lenin reprinted all of Nechayev's work, and Nechayev, among other things, Nechayev outlined an order of execution. These people, their goal was to destroy the world as it exists, and they all say that. Lenin said that, Marx said that, and they're all about destruction. And this guy laid out the plan for destruction. And he, but he was a true believer. And, you know, the thing about that is that before any of this system was imposed, these people, and I think all Marxists share this, and a lot of leftists who aren't, that aren't Marxists, a lot of liberals, share this belief that they're smarter than everybody else, and they have this vision of the future. Now, in the 1800s, when Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, it had never been tried. So they could imagine that whatever they came up with was going to be the answer to all the world's problems. And so these people, they're just absolutely mind-bogglingly conceited, arrogant beyond belief, so arrogant that they believed that they had the right to destroy the world as it existed to create a pathway for this utopian communist future. But even that was sold. Communism was sold, you know, two chickens in every pot. You know, we'll redistribute the wealth from the greedy rich and give it to you. So it appealed to people's basest instincts of greed and envy in order to justify a system where all of that was supposed to disappear. And of course, you know, Marx said, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Of course, he never, in a factory, he had no knowledge of what the working class was, what it did, no association with them. His father was a wealthy attorney, and he spoiled him endlessly. And he thought his brilliant Marxism was going to solve the problems of the world. Instead, what it did was create a system of slavery where all of those workers, and everybody else for that matter, were put in chains forever. You know, the people in the Soviet Union, Russia today, are still in those chains. The communist Chinese, except for the top members of the Communist Party, who are extremely wealthy, everybody else works for a pittance, and they can't say anything or do anything against the regime.
Well, you have parasites. It's an interesting idea. You know, we think of being entrepreneurs in the United States and other free societies that you try to make better products, better goods and services, make a better mousetrap, serve your fellow man, and you know, they'll pay you for these good ideas here, whereas here precisely all of these talents and skills are directed towards political power and dominating your fellow man. It's interesting.
Yeah.
In your book, you talk a lot about, as others have analyzed, this phenomenon of the cultural Marxism coming out of what's called the Frankfurt School, the Institute for Social Research that was founded in Frankfurt, Germany in 1923. And then later, the scholars behind individuals behind this Frankfurt School when Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933, they had to come to the United States and set up shop at Columbia University as well as elsewhere in New York City. Discuss this cultural Marxism and the Frankfurt School. I mean, it seems to be that, you know, people talk about, well, we won the Cold War in the beginning of the 1990s and the communist bloc collapsed. Now it seems like we have these battles not with any sort of military force like the Warsaw Pact, but we're looking at a lot of internal upheaval in our society. Hello?
To unite,
James, you there?
Behind them. Yes. Can you hear me?
Okay. I missed you there for a moment.
You got me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The phone disconnected for a second there. I apologize. The communists realized, first of all, that the workers of the world were not going to unite. They were not going to overthrow the capitalist system that they hated so much. So they decided they needed to look at a different strategy. First of all, they weren't going to approach us at our strength. You know, all of the communist countries use Sun Tzu's Art of War as their primary military doctrine. And that involves deception. It involves subversion. It does not call for direct military, conventional military war. And the communists, generally speaking, do not engage in those kinds of battles. The war comes after they've already won. And that's sort of what's happening in the United States. They look at our society and realize that we are open, we're free, we are generous, believe in fairness, and they use those concepts in our open society to infiltrate all the institutes of our society, all the institutions, you know, the military, the media, Hollywood, academia, and then they subvert those institutions and turn them to their power. And Nechayev wrote about that right at the beginning. He said that they had to penetrate all the institutions of society. He says, aiming at implacable revolution, the revolutionary may and frequently must live within society while pretending to be completely different from what he really is. For he must penetrate everywhere, into all the higher and middle classes, into the houses of commerce, the churches, and the palaces of the aristocracy. You know, this was written during Russia times, and into the worlds of the bureaucracy and literature and the military. And so he laid that out, And the Frankfurt School, founded in Germany in 1923, was forced to move when Hitler took power. Most of the communists were also Jewish, and they fled to the United States and were reinstituted at the Columbia Teachers College, where they began preaching their poison to all the up-and-coming teachers that would later fill something like 60% of the universities throughout the country.
Well, talking about now we have, I believe, you have the New School of Social Research, which is sort of the legacy organization of this previous Frankfurt School, this Institute for Social Research founded in 1923. That, I believe, is at New York University. What are they doing today?
Well, John Dewey, who is called the father of public education, very much liked the Soviet system, and he brought these professors to the United States, some of them, placed some of them in Columbia Teachers College. Then he founded the New School for Social Research at New York University, and that still exists. After World War II, the Frankfurt School was reinstituted in Frankfurt, Germany, but the New School for Social Research continues at New York University, and they brag, if you go look them up, they brag about their Frankfurt School roots. And the Frankfurt School, the communists of the Frankfurt School took up Marx's call for a criticism of everything existing. Before Marx even wrote the Communist Manifesto, he wrote, "We must be involved in a ruthless criticism of everything existing." So the Frankfurt School came up with a fake philosophy they called critical theory. And critical theory criticizes every aspect of Western society and culture, including church, the family, the military, capitalism. Go down the list, and I have a long list included in the book, but the whole idea is to tear down and discredit Western society and culture, and the purpose was to corrupt our culture to the point where we didn't believe in it. We thought we were ashamed of our past. We were ashamed of our history. And in those circumstances, we aren't willing to defend our own country. And that's where we are today with critical race theory, which is just downstream from critical theory. There are dozens of critical theories today, critical race theory just being one of them. But these are all communist-founded ideas to criticize every aspect of Western society and culture. And it's really nothing more than a military strategy of divide and conquer. That's what it is at its base. Are you hearing me? Hello?
Hello, Jim?
Yeah.
Jim?
What happened?
Oh, okay.
Yeah?
Oh, I must have knocked something. I must have hit a button here. But, yeah, as I was saying, what's happened then to our Cold War victory from the beginning of the 1990s in the United States and in America today, if you're talking about all of these ideologies that are overturning our rule of government and whittling away at our freedoms?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly what's happening. That's exactly what they're trying to do. And, you know, many of these organizations, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and many others, Democratic Socialists of America, actually work with and have trained by the East German communists who are legacy people left over from the East German KGB called the Stasi. They actually work directly with them. So this is not a homegrown, strictly a homegrown revolution here. This is part of a worldwide movement, communist movement, to destroy and overthrow our country.
That raises interesting questions. If we talk about then this new struggle, of people like Charles Kessler at Harvard University have argued that we're in a cold civil war, right? You know, again, this idea that we're no longer facing a military threat, but you know, the important battles today are within society, in the courts, and in the schools, and the media. Are Americans recognizing that properly? What do we need to do to get Americans involved in such a struggle?
Well, you know, I think Americans are starting to wake up, and it remains to be seen whether or not enough of them will wake up in time. One indication that they are is the revolution going around across the country on school boards all over the country, people having finally found out what the public schools are indoctrinating their children with, the garbage that they're indoctrinating their children with while they're not teaching them. Many school boards are now being overthrown by people who are concerned with making education again. And that's happened in many places, and it's something that is really nonpartisan because most parents want their kids to, you know, learn how to read and write and do arithmetic and build skills that will allow them to prosper when they're adults. They don't want their kids indoctrinated with critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, transgender activism. What on earth does that have anything to do with teaching children in public schools? It has nothing to do with it. And the public school system has gone way beyond its authority in attempting to impose these radical, destructive, anti-American ideologies. You know, they're really the tip of the spear of the Frankfurt School's critical theory effort to discredit our entire society and destroy it.
Well, you know, you talk about bipartisan awakening and, you know, particularly this important battle of the school boards and in education. Where's the Democratic Party in all of this? Have they just become fellow travelers of these revolutionary ideologies and groups? You know, why would someone like Joe or Hunter Biden want to support a movement like the BLM movement? What are they doing in all of this?
Well, they're part of it. I mean, to be honest, the Democrats decided, many decades ago, that they wanted to be on the winning side, and they thought the winning side was communism. So for decades, the Democrats have been working against America. And, I mean, that was obvious during the Reagan administration when members of the House of Representatives went to Nicaragua to talk with Daniel Ortega, communist Sandinista Daniel Ortega, about how to prevent Reagan from deposing the communists in Nicaragua. I mean, it's treason as far as I'm concerned. But there's nothing new about it. They've been involved, many members of the House of Representatives were members of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, which was founded by one of the Handel brothers, who were the two co-founders of the guerrilla insurgency that launched a civil war in El Salvador. And these people were right there with them. So it's not new, but now it's become out in the open. Joe Biden has been beholden to a communist organization from the very first time he was elected. He was supported by the Council for a Livable World, and that is a communist organization that gave him the resources he needed to become a U.S. senator when he was a young man. And they have supported many other Democrat politicians, and so they are beholden to them. Now, Joe Biden, I believe, he's never very smart. He cheated in law school. He was not going to be a very successful attorney. So he looked to politics and said, hey, I can sell myself to the highest bidder. I'll make a lot of money. And that's just what he's done. And the highest bidder is now the Chinese Communist Party, to whom he is completely beholden. And there are many, many members of the Democrat Party and sadly some Republicans who are equally beholden to the communist Chinese.
Well, you know, you talk a lot about this book, talking about cultural Marxism and school boards and education. You know, it seems to be that, you know, sex not only sells, but seems really important for socialist agendas. Talk about, you know, like Georgi, if I'm pronouncing his name right, Georgi Lukács in Hungary,
Lukács.
And all of this sex education and the cultural terrorism. How does that fit in with all of these socialist agendas?
You know, right in the early 20s, when the Soviets were getting their act together, looking to offensively expand communism around the world, they held many meetings of the Communist International in Moscow. And one of the keynote speakers was a guy named Willy Munzenberg, who was a master organizer. Willy Munzenberg created the Popular Front concept. And so, for example, in Hollywood, they had the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, which was nothing more than a cover for communist propaganda and a communist recruitment tool for Hollywood actors and actresses. And but Munzenberg said, we must organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink, because only then, when we have corrupted all its values and made life impossible, can we impose communism. And Georgi Lukács was the minister of culture in the short-lived Hungarian Soviet Republic in 1919, and he imposed an agenda which he called cultural terrorism. And it was a nationwide effort to bring explicit sex education to children in public schools, and a nationwide campaign telling women to leave their husbands and go out and sow their wild oats. And it shocked the largely conservative Catholic population of Hungary, and they realized that this communist government was dangerous, and so the military couldn't recruit anybody to fight for them. So when Yugoslavia invaded, they were driven right out. But Georgi Lukács was the featured speaker in 1923 in Germany at something called the Marxist Study Week. And this was financed by a guy named Herman Weyl. And Herman was the, of course, young, spoiled brat, rich son of a wealthy German industrialist. And he thought Marxism was really cool, like all of these idiots think. And so they had this week-long conference, and Georgi Lukács was the featured speaker, and Lukács just enthralled all of them. And the outcome of that was a decision by Herman Weyl to underwrite the creation of the Frankfurt School. And you got to remember, Georgi Lukács was the first person to suggest that they use sex as a weapon for cultural corruption. That's why he called it cultural terrorism. As a weapon, using unleashing, human lust as a way of corrupting our morals, destroying Christianity, and making our nation weak. Now, one of the Frankfurt School communist professors, a younger one, was a guy by the name of Herbert Marcuse. And Herbert Marcuse took Lukács' ideas and he expanded on them. And he wrote a book in the 1950s called Eros and Civilization, where he advocated something he called polymorphous perversity. And he advocated that everybody just engage in any and all kinds of sexual activity they wanted. He is called the father of the sexual revolution. He's credited with the slogan, Make Love, Not War. The 1960s radicals of the Students for Democratic Society were completely taken by Marcuse, and Marcuse has been named the father of the new left. And so he created the idea for the sexual revolution that would his idea or the that would follow through on Munzenberg's idea to make Western civilization so corrupt that it stinks. And that's what has happened. Our civilization has become morally corrupted, morally degenerate, and then along with other aspects of critical theory, we've become ashamed of our heritage, ashamed of our culture. And what's the real goal there? The goal is to make us weak, make us unwilling to defend ourselves. It is a military strategy of conquest. It has nothing to do with sexual freedom. It has nothing to do with transgender rights. It has to do with corrupting our culture and corrupting our society and making it ripe for takeover.
James?
Yeah.
James? Oh, yeah, I lost you there for a moment. You mentioned Hungary, and I believe the book you said Romania invaded Hungary. They had a war, and then that overthrew this Béla Kun Soviet Republic in 1919, right, that was in power for a couple of months after World War I. How is Eastern Europe, Hungary reacting to these forces of cultural Marxism? Our countries like Hungary, they've gone through communism. I mean, first in this brief 1919 Soviet Republic, and then, of course, later after World War II under this Soviet communist occupation throughout the Cold War. Are they better prepared to deal with these issues? Do they have a better knowledge of what's going on here?
No, not really. I mean, the fall of communism that supposedly occurred in 1991 was a false flag operation that had been planned for decades. Are you hearing me?
Yeah, I'm hearing you fine. Excellent.
Okay. It was a phony misdirection to get the West to drop its defenses. It's a Sun Tzu strategy called deny your enemy an enemy. And when it first happened, Gorbachev said it publicly at a speech I think he gave to the Hudson Institute, or it might have been Heritage, I forget. But he said that, we are denying you an enemy. Edward Shevardnadze, who was then the president of the Ukraine, said the same thing on CNN. And so did Georgi Arbatov, who was the head of the Institute for the Study of U.S. and Canada, and he was an old KGB hand. The idea was that the Berlin Wall would fall. That was all ordered by Gorbachev, and that Eastern Europe would emerge from communism democracies, but they were controlled democracies. And as we're seeing in Poland, as we've seen wherever they attempt to really exercise any independence from Russia, they are restrained from that effort. And I think the strongest example of that was when Poland, you know, it's been really the most anti-communist country of all the East Bloc countries. And they were really trying to flex their muscles. And the Russian Putin called them over to Moscow for a conference, forced them all onto one plane, all of the top leaders of Poland onto one plane, and then that plane crashed before it landed in Russia, and they were all killed. And that, in as far as I'm concerned, that was a deliberate staged sabotage of that flight in order to wipe out that leadership and provide a gruesome object lesson for any other Eastern European leader who would really decide to fully break and genuinely break from the Soviet Union. None of them have. Ukraine is in the same situation.
Well, so you're saying, you know, people within the Soviet Communist Party, they were thinking, well, the Soviet bloc, you know, we're failing economically, but so if we just sort of let a collapse of the Soviet bloc happen, we can somehow revive our power later in other ways.
No, because they are never concerned about their economy. That's the great secret of socialism everywhere. It would not have existed for 6 months, but for the help, the loans, aid that Soviet Union got, Communist China got, they've all gotten from the West ever since the beginning. And in the Soviet Union, Lenin created a very clever program, which was called the New Economic Policy. The economy had failed, as it always does with all communist economies. The economy just goes down the tank within months because they confiscate every bit of property, every bit of wealth, and businesses can't operate. Nothing operates. So the entire economy freezes. And what Lenin did was, it was actually called Operation Trust. The public name was the New Economic Policy, where he would allow the private sector to thrive. He would open the door to opposing political parties and bring back at least some semblance of democracy. But it was all a fake. The West immediately breathed a big sigh of relief. Oh, we don't have to fight them anymore. We can relax now. And in fact, we can make money by going in and helping build factories in the Soviet Union. So that's what they did. Ford built a big truck plant. And the West has continually bailed out the Soviet Union since the beginning. And the latest collapse, it just never happened. It never happened. And, you know, the proof of that is that right after this so-called collapse, when they couldn't afford to, they couldn't rub two nickels together, they were modernizing their missile force. Where'd they get the money to do that if they're so broke? You know, the whole thing was a deception. And as Sun Tzu said, all war is deception. So they never, the economies never really collapsed. They feigned collapse, and then guess what? A whole bunch of Western businessmen came in with flooded them with a whole bunch more money, and they got it all over again. Communist China did the same thing.
Well, talking about, you know, all of this recently in all of this talk about cultural Marxism in the Frankfurt School, there's Paul Kengor wrote about this at the American Spectator. There's been this charge that's been made that to criticize cultural Marxism is anti-Semitic. Is that true?
Well, you know, it's really funny. Marx hated everybody, called blacks the N-word. He supported slavery. He called the proletariat that he supposedly championed stupid boys, rogues, asses. He criticized, hated everybody, and he was especially vicious towards Jews. Now, Marx himself was a Jewish heritage, but he was raised as a Christian in Lutheran Germany at the time. Jews couldn't practice their professions. So his father converted to Christianity as a practical move so he could continue in business. And then Marx was born, and his father became very, very wealthy, and Marx was showered with all kinds of, you know, benefits, a spoiled brat, rich kid. But Marx hated Jews. He was very anti-Semitic because all of the Marxists today believe Marx was infallible. Every aspect of his thinking has to be followed to the letter. And that is why there are so many, why anti-Semitism, well, that's one of the reasons. The other reason, it's another divide and conquer strategy. But the left, as you know, demonstrated most aptly by the Squad, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, AOC, et cetera, virulently anti-Semitic, and none of the Democrats will, you know, chastise them for anything they say about it. And it's because the Democratic Party, party of anti-Semitism. And why? Because Marx was a virulent anti-Semite. All of the communist professors from the Frankfurt School who were also Jewish were virulently anti-Semitic Jews. So even though they had to flee Hitler's Germany, they probably would have rejoiced with what Hitler was doing to the Jews, because they hated Jews as much as he did. And that's the reality. And so for anybody to suggest it's anti-Semitic to criticize Marx is a height of absurdity. You there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I've faded out from. Yeah. Well, that's. I guess so. You're saying that maybe even these individuals from Jewish backgrounds in the Frankfurt School, they were more aligned with, like, you know, thinking of what later Stalin was going to do in the Doctor's Plot after World War II, or suggested that he was also going to. Evidence indicates he was also going to start up a genocide there as well, sort of replay what Hitler did. You know, you have so these individuals that are more committed to Marxism and sort of this internationalism, and they reject any heritage they have in Judaism. Well, you know, in your book, you actually focus.
No, that's exactly right. That is exactly right. Communists are communists first, last, and always. They're all about the agenda. Communist Jews, leftist Jews want to see Israel destroyed every bit as much as the Palestinians do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Well, in this book, you know, you actually focus a fair amount on religion. Do you think, you know, the battle with socialism and with Marxist forces, is this ultimately then a spiritual battle? I mean, what role does religion here play?
Well, it absolutely is a spiritual battle, because Marxism, communism, leftism, it is all demonic. I mean, everything they do is the opposite of the truth, and everything they are doing is overtly evil. And we can see that being played out throughout our country. And we are in a spiritual battle, because Marxism, the appeal of Marxism comes right out of the Garden of Eden, where Satan told Adam and Eve that ye shall be as gods. And that is exactly the temptation that Marx and all the communists see in this strategy or body of strategies called communism. That's what the appeal is. They shall be as gods. And in fact, Marx says as much, doesn't he, in a poem that he wrote. And I quote that poem right at the beginning of my book. Listen to this. This is Karl Marx's poetry. "Disdain, I will throw my gauntlet full in the face of the world and see the collapse of this pygmy giant, whose fall will not stifle my ardor. Then I will wander godlike and victorious through the ruins of the world, and giving my words an active force, I will feel equal to the Creator." So in other words, Marx was talking as though he were Satan. You know, he didn't say God doesn't exist. He said, I'm going to challenge God for supremacy.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, in your own background, in your own experience, I guess I assume you go to church. Have you had any confrontations with any sort of, you know, what you indicate sort of infiltration of religious groups of churches by leftist groups?
Well, not at my church, because my church is very committed to teaching the Bible. And as such, the people that are attracted to it have no interest in that. And nobody that has ever joined that church has ever attempted to, you know, change how it operates. But many churches have been infiltrated by the left, and it's one of the many strategies. You know, Bella Dodd, a former communist who was a Catholic, she was ordered in the 30s by the Communist Party to infiltrate her church, as were many communist Catholics, to infiltrate and subvert the church. Now, she had an epiphany and realized it was wrong, became a committed Christian, and wrote a book about the infiltration of the Catholic Church. But it's happened to churches, all of the churches, and it started around the turn of the last century, around 1900, you know, with the movement of ecumenism, I think that's the way to say that. Ecumenical, the idea is to blend all religions together, and it does not work. Christianity is Christianity. And, you know, the social gospel, actually, which is just a different form of communism, started being preached in the 1930s. And then the liberation theology was created by the KGB to infiltrate the Catholic Church in South America, because the communists saw South and Central America as essential places, staging grounds for the eventual overthrow of the United States. But the trouble was that all of those nations were very, very strong conservative Catholics, very anti-communist. And so they had to do something about that. So they created liberation theology, and a Peruvian priest introduced that, and it began shifting, with the help of the Jesuits, began shifting the entire focus of the Central and South American church away from traditional Catholicism to liberation theology, which is nothing more than religious Marxism.
Well, you know, talking about ecumenism, you talk in the book how you oppose interfaith efforts with Muslims because, you know, these often just degenerate into efforts to promote Islam, get people to convert to Islam, and there's no, you know, no criticism of Islam allowed, or, you know, any effort to try to encourage Muslims to, say, convert to Christianity. How do Marxists view, you know, I think of, for example, members of Code Pink I recently saw at the Lincoln Memorial joining in with this anti-Israel rally with all these Muslims who are screaming Takbir, Allahu Akbar, and making anti-Israel chants. How do such a, you know, Marxist aligned individuals like Media Benjamin from Code Pink, how do they look at Muslims? I mean, what are the relationships and what they to do with, say, Muslim immigrant populations here in the United States?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and I've written actually two books about it with the title The Red-Green Axis, and it is an alliance between radical Muslims and radical leftists. And the thing you have to understand is all of these efforts have one goal, and that is to overthrow the United States. And Israel is our strongest ally in the Middle East. So, of course, that becomes a target. You know, Israel is a tiny island of freedom and democracy in a sea of very malevolent dictatorial states. And they want to see Israel wiped off the map. And actually, it's funny, not all of them really do, but they don't have a choice because the radicals in their countries basically force their hand. That's very true of the Saudis. But the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the primary vehicle for Islamic doctrine being spread throughout the world, has been controlled by the KGB since the end of World War II. Most people don't know that. But if you think about it, when Hitler was defeated, the Muslim Brotherhood found another patron, and that patron was the Soviet KGB, which provided them with arms, with training, with intelligence, with money. The Soviet KGB created the Palestine Liberation Organization, which now is the Palestinian Authority, led by Abu Mazen, who was a PLO terrorist, just as Yasser Arafat was. These people are all communists. And Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood organization. And the Muslim Brotherhood has been controlled by the communists since the 50s. So it's really not so much of a stretch to see that they are allied with the hard left. And in fact, even Osama bin Laden said in a 2003 video broadcast by Al Jazeera that he said, in defeating the great Satan, it would not be inappropriate for us to ally ourselves with the socialists, even though the socialists are apostates. And so this alliance between the red, which are the communists, and the green, which are the Islamists, has been going on since really the 50s. And it's not new, and there's really no difference between them. The head of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Nihad Awad, before he switched to lead CARE, which is the public relations front for Hamas in the United States, Nihad Awad was the head of the Palestinian Students Association, which was the student leadership for the Palestine Liberation Organization. So in other words, he was a communist before he became a leader of care. And I would argue that he still is, because at the top, they're all the same. Many of the leaders from Iran went and got training at Moscow University. These people do not, they really don't care about Islam. Just like the communists, they care about establishing themselves with absolute power and wealth, and they put on the Islamic garb and pray to Allah when the public is looking, just to keep up appearances.
Well, I guess in closing, that's interesting. More, you know, you're talking about more cynicism there. Does this sort of
it's not cynicism?
Align...
It's fact. It's not cynicism.
Right.
It's fact.
Right, but not. I mean, towards their ideologies, in this alliance of convenience, what could is there any way? Does this offer any sort of strategy that conservatives could use to counter this? I mean, if you look at these fundamental differences in ideologies between any sort of Islamist ideology and a Marxist ideology, how could conservatives exploit that to try to combat this?
Well, you really can't in terms of trying to divide them. I mean, you can point out the hypocrisy of organizations like CARE supporting the LGBTQ community, where, you know, the traditional Islamic response to gays is to behead them. You know, you can point out the hypocrisy. You can question it. But the fact of the matter is that they are all radical leftists. I mean, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, they're both members of Democratic Socialists of America, which is the largest communist organization in the United States. So they're really... at the heart, they're all leftists, and the whole aspect of Islam is just another divide and conquer strategy. These people are radical leftists. They say repulsive, anti-American things. They do anti-American, treasonous things. But if you criticize them, well, then you're an Islamophobe. So it's just another way for them to sow division. And our way of defeating that is to first reestablish a strong majority in state houses, in local governments, and in Congress, and in the White House, and then starting to reel this stuff back. And in the meantime, organizations like school boards have a lot of power. They can throw, there's a lot of Islamic doctrine being taught in schools now. You might ask, how is it that they're teaching Islamic doctrine when Christianity is banned? You know, if we're not supposed to be teaching religion, how is it that they're getting away with it? Well, the fact of the matter is the people who put that in there are leftists who are seeking to destroy Christianity and using Islam to assist them in that goal and create further divisions, inflame further divisions. We throw those people out of office, and then we reestablish public schools to teach the things they're supposed to teach and start getting people back on track. And, you know, it's very late in the game. I don't know if we'll be able to do it, but that is our task. To regain political power at the federal, state, and local level and make the changes that most people want, even though many of them would be afraid to admit it publicly right now because they're afraid of being shamed. But you give them the option, and everybody will vote with their feet. You know, there was a school board election here in Queen Anne County, Maryland, small rural county, where the head of the school boards, the black lady that wanted to impose critical race theory, and this married couple objected, and they decided it was too late to get on the ballot to run for school board. The husband ran on a write-in ballot. They got somebody else to run run on a write-in ballot, and they needed 500 votes to win. They got 12,000 write-in votes. They overthrew the school board, kicked that lady out, and now they're going to restore the schools in that county to the kind of traditional teaching that everybody wants. And that's the kind of reaction they got from the voting public in that small community. It's happening all over the country. Sioux Falls, South Dakota just threw out all the leftists. And that's the biggest school district in the entire state. And that's happening all over the country. People are getting fed up. And that's one of the key areas because, you know, we all care so much about our children. But as more and more things that the left does begin impacting everybody as they already are, and people start seeing how insane their agenda is, we're going to, if we capitalize on that and take advantage of it, we could take back our country. But it's going to be a rough road, and it's going to take a lot of fighting.
All right, then. Well, on that note here for our listeners, we'll close out another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we've been discussing the new book, Who Was Karl Marx? The Men, the Motives, and the Menace Behind Today's Rampaging American Left, with the author of the book, investigative journalist James Simpson. James Simpson, thank you for joining us for the show. And for our viewers, tune in next time for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.
Thanks so much,
Andrew. Thank you, Jim.